From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents part one in a series of discussions about contemporary American religious thought and practice. Is there continuity or disjunction between religious thought and behavior in America today? What are the conditions of religious practice, both orthodox and unconventional? Who defines religion in America? Addressing those and other questions, the panelists are Martin Marty, James English, Mark Taylor, Harmon Smith, and Marjorie Heyer. Martin Marty is a professor at the University of Chicago and an editor of the Christian Century. Among his books is Righteous Empire, which won the National Book Award in 1971. James English is a Jesuit priest who has served as pastor of Holy Trinity Church in Georgetown, Washington, D.C. Mark Taylor and Harmon Smith recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. Marjorie Heyer is religion writer for The Washington Post. Here is Martin Marty.
My hunch is that most people act on the basis of their deepest beliefs, or arrange their deepest beliefs to match their patterns of action. And so I don't think there's as big a gap as people often presume exists between thought and behavior. It's that people believe different things than you think they believe. I would give as an illustration the great shift we've seen in the last 20 years in those American churches which H. Richard Niebuhr called the churches of the disaffected. The people who'd been in the back country and in the hills and the poor parts of the country had an intense otherworldly religion. They had an explanation for why nothing worked in life. And now in the last 20 years, they become, in many respects, the most prosperous elements in American religion. They belong to populations that are on the move from lower middle class to upper middle class. They belong to institutions, denominations that collect great numbers of funds, and if you would watch them on late night television or read their best-selling books or look at who their heroes are, they are all successful business people, successful politicians, successful beauty queens and athletic stars. And so one gets the sense that the behavior and the beliefs don't match. Whatever happened to hell? Yet if you listen, you'll find the beliefs have actually undergone a drastic shift. They don't preach hellfire anymore. They preach the advantages of being saved and the prosperity that will result from it. Therefore, I don't see great bad faith there. There's an adjustment of belief, and nobody noticed that the adjustment was going on.
Is there some relationship between the hunger after understanding, the hunger after God, and the formulation of your ability to plunge into that hunger and begin to satisfy it? And it seems to me there is a great hunger right now after God and understanding in American life. I think for a long time belief in God has had to do with blessing in your life. Blessing is understood in American terms: material prosperity, health, happiness. I think we've gotten beyond that right now because we've had that and it isn't sufficient. And those most blessed with those things seem sometimes to be the unhappiest among us. And so there is some sort of a further move beyond that understanding of God and God's presence to, I think, a more profound understanding of God as mystery and what that mystery is, how it includes suffering, how it includes the things we dread.
We really have a couple of questions before us now on what is religion and what is measurable belief in religion. I don't think if we were given a few years we could define religion with any precision. I think we can point. When something shows up, we say that's what the human race has always called religious. In the narrowest sense, some people would say religion is what goes on under the dome of a synagogue or the steeple of a church. Clearly, it's more than that. Other people connect the word religion with almost every system of symbols. Well, if everything's religious, then nothing's religious. So clearly we need some intermediate indicators. As Father English just said, there's a hunger for God. You can't use that word without the whole world saying that's religious. On the other hand, poetry may make no mention of God and yet may treat nature as sacred, and we say there's at least a religious sense there. I always watch for what Paul Tillich called ultimate concern as a clue. Religious people tend to prefer the language of symbol and myth to other forms. Most religious people suggest their explanations for what goes on that go beyond what your normal sense experience tells you. Religious people like to indulge in rites and ceremonies. They want a certain kind of behavior. You don't eat this or you don't do that on that day. The other point then is, once you've established, I guess the best I could say, a zone in which religion occurs, then yes, I believe belief is measurable, again, a wide range of standards. I don't think we can say that once upon a time everybody knew and believed formal dogma, and that defined the church, and today very few do. I think there was a time when formal dogma could be used in a church or a culture more precisely. Well, there are some people in American religion that use dogma, creed, as a boundary. Who's in, who's out. Sometimes, Eric Hoffer says, love of orthodoxy is more mutual suspicion than its love of truth. But the place where I find it most interesting to measure is to see what people think the teaching of the church is and whether they're living by it. And I think that's extremely fluid in America, including in the most conservative groups around.
I quite agree with Marty that the task of trying to define in any precise way the distinctiveness of religious belief is probably an impossible one. Though I would like to emphasize, I think, a different reason for that, though I think Marty would agree with me. The task has been enormously complicated by our increasing sensitivity to the multiplicity of religious beliefs and to different cultural traditions, so that I think it would be a mistake to conduct a conversation like the one we're conducting here and to think of the problem of religion simply within the context of the American tradition, which is itself enormously complex and pluralistic, of course, without being aware of the different forms of religious belief in different cultures. That has had an enormous impact on the way in which we understand in this country, both as practitioners and as scholars of religion, the nature and function of religion. And I think the sensitivity to these other religious traditions is certainly one of the most important facets of the contemporary scene.
I think the key point of what Mark Taylor just says for our subject, namely defining religion now in our culture, is this one, and it's been recognized also by the Supreme Court, that historically, if you'd ask an American what religion is, he or she would likely say it's belief in God. And yet, many things that all Americans would call religion doesn't have a belief in God. When I hear someone in Congress say we have to have school prayer because everyone knows religion is good and everyone wants to pray and they want to pray to God, I remind them that California has had a Buddhist Senate chaplain who doesn't believe in God, and yet he's a perfectly good Buddhist. The Supreme Court reminds us that Taoism, Zen Buddhism, ethical culture, and some forms of religious secular humanism are obviously religious and don't believe in a supreme being. I think when that was introduced on the court level, the public for the first time had to reckon with a much larger definition of what it is to be religious than before. Now, here and there, when someone makes really outlandish claims, I heard once in a state prison, after the black Muslims got some rights to have dietary functions met, one group got together and said, well, we have a new religion that demands steak every night. Mm-hmm. And the court here said, well, you're playing games with us now. There is a kind of a self-named Coptic church whose fundamental belief is smoking marijuana. And there's a gang in Chicago, El Rukin, that is basically a heroin trade group, I think, that calls itself religious. Well, there are perhaps boundaries. But in general, if you call yourself religious, the court has to see you as religious.
I don't myself, Marty, find it absurd at all that given the latitude of the court's decision to which you referred, that it would be legitimate for anybody and everybody on whatever premises or predicates or warrants to nominate anything under the sun as religion. The word means to retell tie, to reunite, to bind together, to religate. And historically, the function of that word was to describe an attempt by people to reunite themselves with the source of their being, or what they called God. If that understanding of what religion is has now been so eroded as to allow the kinds of groups you describe together, I would guess, with things like EST, other self-help, self-fulfillment, really egocentric kinds of movements, which have no intention to be bound to anything except radically insulated ego, the perversion of the word itself and all the conceptual apparatus that attends it seems to me then to render a conversation about religion qua religion absurd. I don't understand why it is that out of a misplaced compassion for individual liberty, a word like religion can be heir to such protean kinds of definition.
But isn't there a distinction, Harmon Smith, between what is defined as religion for the purposes of the courts and purposes of the Constitution, and what you and I call religion in terms of conversation? I think the crucial issue that Marty was talking about is that there be no excessive entanglement of the courts in defining religion or even in religious functions. And this is, of course, one of the problems that comes up in trying to legislate, as attempts have been made from time to time to legislate and regulate various cult groups in this country.
Can we make some sort of clarity as regards religion by the distinction between what is based on theology and what is philosophy? Theology is always includes a philosophy with it. Philosophy does not always include a theology. Is religion somehow centered upon a study of God, theology, a supreme being?
I don't think it works. It goes a long way to clarifying theology in the Judeo and Christian and Western traditions, but we're still back in that issue of what is manifestly religious but has no theos or God to talk about. And I just don't know how you can sit in the United States and say that the tens, if not hundreds of millions of people in the world, who in every encyclopedia you ever own are called religious but don't have a God, can now be ruled out from religion. I think getting back to Harmon Smith's version of this thing, we always have to ask, toward what end do we want to define? Right. If it is to determine what goes into a curriculum, I have great freedom to determine what I consider serious to bring to people's attention. If I'm unfortunate enough to be in a court, I'm in a society where people have certain practices, most notably tax exemption of religious organizations, which they've decided, they've told the court, they've told through the ballots through the years, that we want this to happen. Whatever it does to constitutions, we want this to happen. Now, the court sits there with a clause that says that Congress, and now after the 14th Amendment, the states, shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. Well, now you have to define what you're establishing. Some people say, aha, now secular humanism, the court has called it religion, and since you can't talk about God in the public schools, you're teaching a religion of secular humanism, and the courts are entangled in it, and they don't want to be. And even more, what is free exercise of religion? And so they have to define. Fundamentally, I would agree with Philip Curlin that the intention of the First Amendment is to try to have the courts be silent about religion. But you don't get that choice, in a way, because people who are very noisy come to the court and claim to be a religion, and the court does have to make some decisions. But the person who reflects about what Reverend Ike and peyote-chewing Native American Church Indians and non-God-believing Buddhists have in common has a different problem of what's going on.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the first segment in a series of conversations about contemporary American religious thought and practice. The panelists are Martin Marty of the University of Chicago, James English, a Jesuit priest in Raleigh, North Carolina, Mark Taylor of Williams College, Harmon Smith of Duke University, and Marjorie Heyer of the Washington Post. The conversation resumes with comments about the proposition that America is a Christian nation, founded on Christian principles. Here is Martin Marty.
Well, it comes in two forms. Are we religious and are we Christian? In 1951, Justice William O. Douglas said in a court decision, quote, "We are a religious people, and our institutions presuppose a supreme being." I think a historian would say the first half of that proposition is demonstrably true, and the second is demonstrably false. I don't think our institutions presuppose a supreme being, because the Constitution, which is our basic document, took great pains not to commit we, the people of the United States, to commit us to a view of belief in a supreme being. Supreme beings can get along without the U.S. Republic, and the Republic could get along without supreme beings. But by any definition, the American people from the beginning, in their popular expression, the choices they make, the self-concept, what they tell the poll taker or whatever, think of themselves as somehow religious. We don't, as historians, have to ask, is it good religion or bad, true or false, traditional or other? We simply have to say, if 95% of the people tell the poll taker, we believe in God, a theologian can come along and say, well, you got a funny bunch of gods, but they are religious. There's no motive to say to a poll taker, I believe in God, unless I conceive of myself as religious. We have been religious. You also raise something, though, that I think has become a lively issue in our own time, and that is, on what were we founded? And I've already alluded to that in the reference to the Constitution, because today many people in the present value crisis, saying that the public schools in particular don't know what to teach children, what values to impart, believe that our only way back would be to go to our roots, and say that our roots are, quote, traditional theism. And there I would disagree with them. I believe that most of the founders, I'm sorry, I have to say founding fathers, because they were all men, were religious. They were energetically religious, but they were religious in reference to a religion that few Americans ever held before or after them. They believed in nature's God being accessible without any book of revelation. They believed in natural law and believed they knew its content. They had a faith in natural reason. And these, in a way, were what were prime. If they then happened to believe, for example, in the deity of Christ, which Thomas Jefferson did not, George Washington took great pains to avoid, most of them could have had a chance, they were church members, and said no, they were not Christian in that sense of the term at all, and many of them were not theistic. They didn't believe in a God whom they could address personally, God the Father, or anything of this sort. When they said God, they really meant this principle of nature and reason and order in the universe. And that is not far from what an awful lot of people who are secular humanists do believe about the universe. So I don't think we can solve our values crisis by saying let's go back to the founders. Almost all of them, while they were of religious sensibilities, would be called secular humanists by a fundamentalist today.
I guess I think that when people talk about America being a Christian nation, they're really talking about America having an understanding that God exists and somehow has a relationship to this country and the individuals in it. I would take the term Christian not to mean that, not to preclude that, but not to mean that. I take the word Christian to mean that someone believes that Jesus Christ was both God and man. In that sense, I don't think America is a Christian nation. I think it is a God-believing nation. I think the number of people who really believe that Jesus Christ was true God and true man is substantial, but not the overwhelming majority.
I think the problem of definition with relationship to Christianity in particular is, in many ways, no less complex than the problem of definition with respect to religion in general. They're related, obviously, but even within the bounds of Christianity itself, if one were to take those who could in some sense claim that Jesus is Lord, That just poses the beginning of the problem, because if you look at the early church councils, or if you and then juxtapose that to 19th and 20th century readings of what that claim might be, one again finds such an enormous diversity of interpretation with respect to that claim that the problem of definition doesn't seem to me to have been overcome by focusing on that particular instance. I just don't think that that the problem can be solved that way.
I guess John Courtney Murray, when he was teaching, has said that the point of theology is to take a mystery and not explain it, but surround it and preserve it and observe it. And I think the claim, Jesus is Lord, is the sort of distinguishing point of a Christian. What precisely the claim means will always be wrapped in mystery and always open to discussion and diverse opinion. So I think we'll always, as long as we have the claim to the mystery, have the discussion and the diversion of what the mystery means. But to assert the mystery, it seems to me, is the hallmark of the Christian.
Here again, we're thrown into the issue of what are the ground rules by which we want to play when we begin a definition. Thus, let's say, if I want to get an argument going as to who's Christian or not, we would first have to agree, shall we use the Bible as the corral or place in which we stake it out? Now, even on those terms, there's tremendous latitude. A few years ago, I read a book by a very conservative Scottish scholar, J.G. Dunn, who asked, was there a common governance of the church? Was there a common form of worship? Was there a common behavior pattern? Was there a common doctrine in the early church as reflected in the New Testament itself? And he said, finally, the only thing you could say about it everywhere is that in their own version or other, all people called Christian would say, quote, the human Jesus is the exalted Lord. That may, for some of them, mean very far from saying he is God. The New Testament is a little cautious about using that phrase more than a couple of times. Son of God, adopted son, many versions of it, but that would be the minimum. Now, we could play by that rule. You still would have all kinds of people in there who aren't regarded as Christian by others or don't want to regard other Christians as among them. And I'll give two illustrations. I have a hunch that members of the Unification Church would all say the human Jesus is the exalted Lord. And yet, because of claims made for a kind of a parallel messiahship, probably relating to the person of the founder, Dr. Sun Myung Moon, there's a little wariness about it, but probably that, most other Christians don't want to call them Christian, though they'd match that particular part of the definition. To flip this over, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints would all certainly say the human Jesus is the exalted Lord, meaning something different by both ends of that spectrum, but I'm not sure they would regard many forms of the Orthodox Christianity that rules them out as being Christian. So that we first have to decide again, is it for legal reasons? Legally, the Constitution is silent. It doesn't care who's Christian or not. Doesn't care who's religious or not. But if you want to write a book on church dogma and church history, if the Bible is the ground rule, you at least have some base for deciding. But beyond that, it's whoever wants to be called Christian is. If the Gallup poll comes along across a liberal American denomination, say the United Church of Christ, or the liberal sectors of Methodism, they find 30, 40, 50% of the people who are unready to say Jesus is God, and yet they wouldn't want to be ruled out of being Christian, and no yearbook of American churches would classify them as other than Christian. A fundamentalist would say they're non-Christian, but they would say the fundamentalist doesn't do justice to the full humanity of Jesus, and therefore that maybe they're not. So we have a real issue here between who determines what the orthodoxy is in definition.
This whole question of is Jesus God was the basis of a really kind of a watershed case in the United Presbyterian Church. It's been settled now, but within the last two or three years, there was a United Church of Christ minister who had been a minister in the United Church of Christ for 10, 12 years down in Florida, moved to one of the suburbs of Washington recently, and to serve in a church that was dually aligned with the United Church of Christ and the Presbyterian Church. And of course, he wanted standing in the presbytery, or had to have standing in the presbytery in order to to take it, take over the position. And in the examination during the presbytery, one of the representatives from one of the more orthodox churches in the National Capital Union Presbytery put to him the question, "Do you believe Jesus is God?" And his answer was, "No, God is God." And he went on to elaborate that. The presbytery voted him in. The person who asked the question and his sympathizers brought the case before through the church courts, and it made its way back and forth through the church courts for about 3 or 4 years. And finally, they had to do a subsequent examination. But this man refused to say, in his terminology, and someone asked him at one in the second examination, "Why will you not say that Jesus is God?" And he said, "That doesn't have any meaning for me." And he articulated in half a dozen different ways what he felt, his own Christology, what he felt Christ's role was, but he refused to put it in the traditional terms, Jesus is God. And as a result of the case, matter of fact, a number of Presbyterian churches around the country dropped out of the United Presbyterian Church and formed their own denomination.
I guess the concern that keeps gnawing at me is the thing that Jim seems to me to be trying to get to, and that is whether at some point, if we can't fix with even a kind of proximate confidence, to say nothing of certainty, some historical understanding of what it is we're talking about when we use language like this, don't we run the very real risk, which seems to me to have happened now and then, of dehistoricizing or ahistoricizing the meaning of this kind of language?
But Harmon, I'm back to the same point again. We have to ask, toward what end? I believe every church body has a right to decide, if it wants to, who's in and who's out. I believe that every cluster of churches that want to form, such as the World Council of Churches, which has a divine Christology formula, has a right to say it. And there have been some Quakers and others who say, we consider ourselves Christian, but we can't say that, so we can't be members. Both sides have a right. There's an integrity to that. Anyone can have a bounding of that sort. But when you ask it on the terms with which we're wrestling today, namely what's religious in America, what's Christian in America, then I have to ask, who of us have the credentials to say we'll measure it by the Bible and nothing else, or by the creeds and nothing else, or the Bible and the creeds and nothing else, when a lot of people, in their interpretation of the Bible and the creed, consider themselves to be Christian but won't assent to the proposition in these terms?
Right.
You've been listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. This has been the first part in a series of conversations about contemporary American religious thought and practice. The panelists were Harmon Smith of Duke University, Father James English of Raleigh, North Carolina, Marjorie Heyer of The Washington Post, Mark Taylor of Williams College, and Martin Marty of the University of Chicago. Harmon Smith and Mark Taylor have recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.